It's the Feels Like the End of the World edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, first some words about the Trump election, then some web wisdom about dark energy, algorithms, and CRISPR genetic engineering. Let's begin episode 357.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. Place where reason and reality cross swords for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns.
We have traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist.
It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it.
This is the end, beautiful friend. This is the end, my only friend.
I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real.
At my head, I wanna drown my sorrow. No tomorrow, no tomorrow. And I find it kinda funny, I find it kinda sad. The dreams in which I'm dying are the best I've ever had. To take when people run in circles, it's a very, very mad world. Mad world.
So it happened. No one, not even yours truly, thought it possible, let alone probable. Donald Trump may be many things now, including president of the most powerful nation in the planet, but he seems to be no fool. Things are moving along quite quickly, and the expected dissection of the Clinton, no, the complete democratic collapse is beginning to be heard. Although there were many, to be quite honest, apocalyptic, bombastic things spoken by Trump in the lead-up to the election, many of these utterances were contradictory, and many times seemed to be made up on the fly just for effect. One thing, though, that does provide me with some comfort. With what I just said, no one can be really sure what a Trump presidency will be like. It was often brought up that until about a decade or two ago, he was a Democrat. However unlikely this could be, as some joked prior to the election, an elaborate prank on the Republican Party that just got out of Trump's hands. So, that comfort. It has been interesting that in interviews he's been doing since the election night, he's been backing away from his more elaborate promises, like the wall between the US and Mexico. He said some parts may be fences instead of walls. And members of the Republican Party toned it down even more by saying drones could be used to create a virtual wall. A similar backdown came on Obamacare, where he said he wouldn't scrap it all, that there were some parts that were very good, like the parts dealing with pre-existing conditions or extending care to dependents, i.e. kids that can stay on their parents' plans for longer. That said, those are tiny steps back, and again, we just don't know. So next week will be the President Trump edition of Radio Free Thinker. We'll do a much more in-depth dive of both the lead-up, the election, and the fallout of a President Trump. That said, there were some uncomfortable hypocrisies on the progressive side. One thing Trump took a lot of heat for was his comments about whether or not he would accept the election results if he lost. And he said, "I don't know. You'll have to wait and see." There were many claims made that this comment was a fundamental attack on the foundations of the American democracy. This showed the fascist side of Trump. And well, it's hard to know what would happen if he did lose, maybe black shirts on the street like Mussolini did almost a century ago. But those are hypotheticals. What I'm seeing are those very same types taking to the street and protesting the vote was rigged, that there's no way America should allow for President Trump. For several days now, there's been rioting and protests in the street. Okay, there's an important caveat to be made. The kind of rigging progressives mean, well, they're pointing it to the Electoral College, something we've covered on the show before, as well as voter intimidation and voter suppression. Not rigged as an illegal, as Trump would have claimed, but institutional and legislative rigging. Now, don't get me wrong, what Trump said was appalling and dangerous. Like I said, who knows what would happen if he had lost? Even prominent Republicans condemned his comments. And, again, to make my view clear, I do think Trump is a complete pending disaster. The election was the pin on the grenade that will blow up next year when he takes office in January 20th, or maybe in a year or two, or maybe in the run-up to his re-election. But blow up, he is likely to do. I fear not only for Americans, people of color, immigrants, the press, science, the environment, climate change, trade war. Trump has the power to invade or attack a country, at least for 90 days. As commander-in-chief, he has the power to tell the military to do what he wants, and only after that 90 days, or he officially declares war, does he actually have to go to Congress and ask for permission. And most terrifyingly in all, is he has the codes. He has the button for the American nuclear arsenal. Maybe his solution to North Korea or Iran is a first strike. So I am no supporter of Trump. I'm not even an apologist for him. Having said that, though, he won fair and square, as per the rules of the game, as fecked as those may be. And now, for progressives to take to the street to prevent him becoming president, well, it seems hypocritical at best, and insurrection at worst. So, we shall see what the future holds. It is my fear that Trump may become, literally, a victim of his rhetoric. As the protests have shown, there is very much a not zero chance, i.e. a likely chance, that someone on the progressive side will take matters into their own hands and, as Trump himself put it, solve the problem with the aid of the Second Amendment. And the risk of such actions increase as the more Trump does in office. But let's say he's not as disastrous as people, including me, fear, that he turns to the center as commander-in-chief. He's still likely to be removed by office by the Second Amendment-type people. Why? Well, to win, he embraced not only the Tea Party, but the alt-right, the very fringe elements of society mainstream politicians disavow. Trump welcomed them on board with open arms. It turns out, if he doesn't build the wall, if he doesn't kick out every illegal immigrant, if he doesn't repeal Roe versus Wade, he doesn't lock up Hillary Clinton, he doesn't start a trade war with China, etc., etc., well, one of those people of the alt-right, one of those fanatical believers in his rhetoric, will just as likely remove him from office, so to speak. And as for those who may not get my inference, the Second Amendment is the part of the U.S. Constitution that allows people to bear and carry arms, i.e. guns, and thus a, quote, solution or remedy involves guns, meaning assassination. Keep in mind, these are things Trump himself suggested. Last note, you may ask, why should we care? Well, beyond being the mouse sleeping next to the proverbial elephant, Trump has threatened to tear up NAFTA, which, oddly enough, I wouldn't mind because of the power it gives to multinational, but understand his actions is his wish to start a trade war. He believes climate change is a hoax by the Chinese to weaken America. Tensions between the U.S. and China haven't been good, but they've been even more strained as China stretches its political and military clout in Southeast Asia in general, and the South China Sea in particular. And remember, he has the bomb. All that means, irrespective of what he might do to ruin American lives, the whole world has a lot to lose as well with a president named Trump. So tune in next week to Radio Free Thinker where we talk about these things. This week, though, we shall cleanse our palate with some completely non-political web wisdom clips. Let's start with a clip that talks about a new study that shows dark energy doesn't exist. Actually, maybe here we'll start with a pair of clips from PBS Digital Studios. This first one explains what dark energy is and how we know it exists. Side note, the next two clips include references to equations. There'll be links in the show notes so you can see what they're talking about. Let's listen and learn.
The idea that the fate of our universe is governed by forces that we can see was abandoned with the discovery of dark matter. However, we now know that the evolution of our universe is driven by something even more mysterious, dark energy. In the last two episodes, we talked about how the fate of the universe can be described using Einstein's general theory of relativity via the Friedman equations. However, there was a problem. Observations show that our universe is infinitely expanding, but it's also geometrically flat. And this is only allowed if we introduce a new type of energy represented by the cosmological constant. We call it dark energy. But what does this dark energy thing actually do? The answer comes from another piece of evidence of its existence, which itself came from an independent attempt to determine whether the universe would recollapse. See, measuring the density of the universe is one way to determine its fate, because the future expansion rate does depend on density. However, so does its past expansion history. In fact, measuring the past expansion history should tell us the future expansion without ever having to count any galaxies. That history is coded in every photon of light that reaches our telescopes from the distant universe. See, as space expands, it stretches out the light that is traveling through it during that expansion. It increases the wavelength of these electromagnetic waves, resulting in what we see as redshift, cosmological redshift. If we also know how long a given photon was traveling through that expanding universe, then its redshift tells us the total amount of expansion that happened during that time. But how do we figure out how much time the light traveled for? Well, we know the speed of light, so we need to figure out how far it traveled, the actual physical amount of space the photon had to traverse to get to us. To measure the expansion history of the universe, we need to measure the redshift distance relationship. We talk about that in detail in this episode. But wait, doesn't redshift tell us distance? Well, sort of, but only if we assume a redshift distance relationship. Redshift is the amount the universe expanded during a photon's journey, and distance is the amount of physical space it traveled through. And the two are connected by the universe's expansion history. Measuring many different redshifts and distances independently of each other tells us that expansion history. No problem. Just measure redshifts and distances for a bunch of things out there in space. Well, not so fast. Although it's not so hard to measure redshift, distance is one of the hardest things to get in astronomy, especially for things so far away that the universe will have expanded significantly in the time it took their light to reach us, so billions of light years distant. You know what would be really handy? If something else happened to that traveling light that independently kept track of the distance it traveled. Oh wait, there is. Faraway things are fainter than nearby things. We just need some source of light out there whose true intrinsic brightness is known. That way, we can figure out how far away it is just by seeing how faint it looks to us. We call such a magical source of light a standard candle. And we kind of got lucky there. There's a very special type of supernova that's both spectacularly bright and for which we can figure out very accurate intrinsic brightnesses, or luminosities. It's a type 1a, or white dwarf, supernova. Take a white dwarf, the leftover core of a dead lower-mass star like our Sun, and let it cannibalize some of the material from a binary companion. When the star reaches a critical mass, a runaway fusion reaction obliterates the star as a supernova. These things explode with very similar and very high luminosities, so they're the perfect standard candle. Okay, so here's the experiment. Watch stars explode across the cosmos. When you catch a white dwarf supernova, you know its distance and redshift. Hypothetically, if the redshift for a given distance turns out to be on the large side, then that would mean the universe expanded a lot during the corresponding light travel time. Now that actually points to a more dense universe. Why? Because if the redshifts are large, then the universe was expanding much faster in the past, which means something would have had to slow it down to its current rate. That something would be a high mass energy content that could, in the future, cause it to recollapse. So, measuring a rapidly expanding universe in the past points to it having had its gravity brakes on between then and now. On the other hand, if the redshift at a given distance turned out to be on the small side, that would mean that the universe expanded less while that photon was travelling. And so a lower density of matter would be needed to explain how the universe slowed down to the current rate of expansion. The smallest redshifts you'd expect would be if the universe has always been expanding at the rate we see now, so almost no matter slowing the universe down. Such a universe would certainly expand forever. We can also flip this logic and say that for a given redshift, we would expect supernovae to be bright or closer in a high-density, recollapsing universe, and faint or more distant in a low-density, infinitely expanding universe. Two separate teams of astronomers spent years catching white dwarf supernovae exploding in galaxies billions of light years away to measure the past expansion history of the universe. They thought this would tell them whether the universe would expand forever or recollapse. But what did they see? In 1998, both teams announced that the universe was expanding even slower in the past than it is now. The redshifts were way too low, or conversely, the supernovae were fainter than you'd expect, even for a universe that has no matter in it at all. That means the expansion rate of the universe has actually sped up, accelerated, while that supernova light was travelling to us. This discovery of the accelerating expansion of the universe earned both teams the Nobel Prize in 2011, and it's considered to be the discovery of dark energy. See, this observation actually came before the discovery of the inexplicable geometric flatness of the universe that we talked about last time. However, this accelerating expansion can be explained with the same bit of math, the cosmological constant, pointing to the same physics, dark energy. Add the cosmological constant to the first Friedmann equation, and we reconcile the left and the right side. But we also see that the constant nature of this term means that the larger the universe, the more of this stuff there is. This lets us interpret the cosmological constant as representing a sort of vacuum energy, a property of space itself, and it must eventually dominate the evolution of the universe. But why should a constant vacuum energy cause the universe to accelerate? Let's take a mathematical ride into the far future, when the galaxies will be so far away that the density of the universe will be basically zero. We know that the universe is flat, so the curvature is also zero. For that far future universe, we can write the first Friedmann equation like this. See, expansion will only depend on the cosmological constant. So does that mean the expansion will become constant? No. See, it's not the expansion rate, the A dot, that's constant in this equation. A dot over A will become a constant. We also call this the Hubble parameter, and it can be thought of as the rate at which the universe doubles in size. The Hubble constant is just the Hubble parameter for the present day. Typically, the Hubble parameter becomes lower over time. But with a positive cosmological constant, the universe will eventually have a constant Hubble parameter, and so will have a constant doubling time. That's exponential growth, and it looks like an accelerating expansion. Currently, there's still enough matter in the universe to influence the expansion rate, but we're already at the point where dark energy dominates. In fact, the universe has been accelerating in its expansion for 6 billion years or so. That's what we see in our white dwarf supernova measurements. If the cosmological constant stays constant, we can expect an exponential growth to continue. But will it stay constant? Could it go down, up? That all depends on what this energy of empty space really is. For that, we'll need another episode of Space Time. In the last episode, we talked about how a general relativistic description of the expansion of the universe requires dark energy. You guys had some excellent questions. Pravar Parekh points out that we can't really know that the universe is flat because we can only see a small part of it. This is absolutely true. We can't rule out curvature below our current best sensitivity, which at the moment is 0.4% of perfect flatness. The universe could be positively or negatively curved below that level. If positively curved, that would mean a finite, but very, very large, greater universe, with a volume at least 250 times that of our observable universe. We talk about that in this episode. However, the degree of curvature required by the first Friedmann equation to agree with the balance between expansion and density is much, much greater than our universe exhibits. Even if the greater universe is curved, we still need dark energy. Yeshwant Fiendler would like to know how we can possibly measure the density of such a huge universe. So the handy thing about a universe that's smooth on its larger scales is you don't have to measure the density of the whole thing, just of enough representative patches of it. Our galaxy surveys have worked for decades to measure brightnesses, redshifts, stellar compositions and more of many millions of galaxies, and even then they don't cover the entire observable universe. However, they do sample a large enough fraction of it to tell us that matter in the universe is pretty smoothly distributed. These surveys don't measure dark matter content of all of their galaxy clusters, but again, we've weighed up the dark matter in enough of them to be able to extrapolate. Thomas Wachlov has a reasonable concern about just adding stuff to your math until it works. Thomas, I hear ya. You can't just do that. William of Ockham turns in his grave. But when the theory, general relativity in this case, is so thoroughly verified in so many other ways, and the addition of the cosmological constant works so well to describe the discrepancy, it strongly suggests that this addition describes something real. As we saw today, the cosmological constant solves two major discrepancies. So at some level, it's right, even if we don't know what causes it or whether it's truly constant.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on 101.9 FM CITR, your center of dark energy and a skeptical universe. Next, we have our second clip from PBS that talks about a paper recently published that claims dark energy does not actually exist. Let's listen and learn.
Did all of dark energy just vanish? A team of scientists have analyzed new data and claim that we need to completely rethink its existence. Back in 1998, two independent teams of astronomers made an extremely controversial announcement that the universe is not only expanding, but that expansion is accelerating. They discovered this by watching for the explosions of Type 1a supernovae. These exploding white dwarf stars have predictable brightnesses that allow astronomers to figure out how far away they are. With a set of reliable distances extending back several billion years, the teams were able to map the expansion history of the universe. They expected to see that this expansion rate was slowing down due to the gravitational effect of all of the matter in the universe. Instead, they found the expansion rate has been accelerating for half of the age of the universe. It appeared that something was acting to counter gravity, an outward pressure that has come to be known as dark energy. The finding led to a shared Nobel Prize for the leaders of the supernova hunter teams, Adam Riess, Brian Schmidt, and Saul Perlmutter. For a deep dive into the mysteries of dark energy, we actually already made this entire playlist on the topic. It's pretty hardcore, so definitely check it out, but maybe after this video. So why are we talking about dark energy again? Because another team has just announced a new analysis of updated supernova data. They claim the data are consistent with there being no dark energy, no accelerating expansion. They suggest the universe may be just expanding at a constant rate, never speeding up, but also not slowing down. This claim is just as controversial as the original discovery of dark energy, because dark energy is now the industry standard. Of course, the media jumped all over this and provided almost no useful info. We thought it would be a good idea to figure out whether we should throw away nearly 20 years of work on dark energy and delete our playlist based on this result. In October 2016, the team of Nielsen, Gufanti and Sakar published a paper titled Marginal Evidence for Cosmic Acceleration from Type 1a Supernovae. It appeared in the prestigious Nature journal, and that helped it get a lot of attention. As with the initial discovery of dark energy, these scientists used Type 1a supernovae to track the expansion history of the universe. However, in the 18 years since the first studies, we've observed a lot more of these exploding white dwarfs, 740 of them, compared to the 10 used by Rees and Schmidt and the 49 by Perlmutter. The new guys claim that the much larger sample is consistent with there being no acceleration, and more data equals more confidence, right? So did dark energy just go away? Actually, not at all. And here's why. The new study actually agrees with the old dark energy result. Mostly. It finds that an accelerating universe containing dark energy still fits the data best. The difference is that it finds that the data is also consistent with a wider range of possible expansion histories. And that range now includes a history in which there never was any acceleration. An accelerating expansion is still preferred, it's just that a non-accelerating history is not excluded with quite the same confidence. I want to talk about how scientists analyze astrophysical data like this. So let's talk numbers. The new study claims a 3 sigma confidence that there is a positive cosmological constant. So quick aside, the cosmological constant written as lambda is the thing you add to Einstein's equations of general relativity to give the anti-gravitational effect of dark energy. If the cosmological constant exists and is larger than zero, then dark energy is a real thing. Okay, so 3 sigma confidence in a positive cosmological constant basically means this. If you repeated this experiment many, many times, about 0.27% of the time, the uncertainties, so the messiness in the data, would cause a universe with no dark energy to just happen to look like one with dark energy. So on average, about 1 in 300 experiments gives you a false 3 sigma result. But given that many thousands of different experiments are being run by professional scientists at any one time, false 3 sigma results do happen. So for a really big scientific claim, like the existence of dark energy, 3 sigma just doesn't cut it. Scientists like to get at least 5 sigma significance. False positive 5 sigma results only happen once per 3.5 million experiments. So the new result doesn't give a high enough significance from the supernova data alone. No one could claim a proof based on that. It's at best a very strong hint. But here's something the press skipped. The original papers by our Nobel laureates also claimed a significance of 3 sigma or lower for a positive cosmological constant based on that early supernova data alone. So why did anyone pay any attention? Because they didn't consider the supernova data alone, and nor should we. If we include other stuff about the universe, our confidence in the existence of dark energy rockets well above 5 sigma for all of these studies. We can't yet observe dark energy directly. We can only infer its existence based on how it affects the expansion of the universe. But that means we have to consider all of the things affecting that expansion when we decide whether dark energy is part of that equation. In fact, there are only 2 factors that can change the way our universe expands. There are things that tend to accelerate expansion, which we call dark energy, and there are things that slow expansion, which is just the gravitational effect of regular energy, and that's mostly dark matter, but also stars, planets, gas, radiation, etc. This graph is how we like to show the balance of these energy types. Dark energy on the y-axis and normal energy, so matter, on the x. To be a bit more precise, these numbers, omega lambda and omega m, represent the fraction of the total energy in the universe that these two types would comprise, assuming that the universe is flat, which it probably is, and I'll get back to that. Those blue ovals represent the ranges of combinations of matter and dark energy that are consistent with the new supernova measurements. Now, statistical hypothesis testing is a whole big topic, and I'll put some links in the description, but very crudely, the inner circle is the most likely region. That's the 95% confidence, one sigma region. But really, Omega Lambda and Omega M could be anywhere in here, although the further from the center, the less likely. The big controversy here is that the 3 sigma contour touches the 0 omega lambda line. So if we consider the supernova data by itself, represented by these contours, there appears to be a small chance that we lie on this part of the graph, little or no dark energy. Except that bottom left corner of the graph also represents a universe that has almost no matter in it either. 0 omega lambda, but also 0 omega m. But our universe definitely has matter in it. We even have a pretty good idea how much. Counting galaxies and weighing dark matter tells us that omega m is probably around 0.3, but it's at least around 0.2. That means we can rule out this entire section of the graph. That alone rules out the region of the supernova results that suggest there's no dark energy. Now, this was known in the late 90s, which is why the first supernova results were taken seriously. Another really powerful piece of evidence is that the balance of omega lambda and omega m define the geometry of the universe. If these add together to equal 1, then the universe is flat. And by that I mean that parallel lines stay parallel, and the angles of triangles add up to 180 degrees, and all the regular rules of geometry work. In a relatively empty, expanding universe, as is represented by this part of the graph, space would not be flat. It would have a weird hyperbolic curvature. I'm going to have to refer you to another vid for details on universe geometries, but the main point is that we can also figure out where we should be on this graph by measuring the geometry of this universe. And as I also talk about in that episode, we can do this using the patterns in the cosmic microwave background to measure the angles of universe-sized triangles. Their geometry appears to be very flat, so our universe should lie on this line here. In fact, I oversimplified slightly, but the CMB results place our universe somewhere in these orange regions, the 1, 2, and 3 sigma contours based on the CMB measurements. That little region where the supernova and CMB results overlap represents the most likely combination of dark energy and matter. When you mathematically combine the certainty contours of 2 completely independent measurements, they give you a much tighter range of possibilities. And the no dark energy region down there is so far from the combined likely region that we could rule it out with much more confidence than even 5 sigma. And there's other evidence leading us away from that little corner also, like baryon acoustic oscillations, but I'm going to have to leave that one to our previous episodes also. But to wrap up, everything we know about the way gravity works, combined with the expansion history that we measure, tells us that there has to be something out there countering the gravitational effect of matter and flattening the geometry of space. It's not even like accelerating expansion is that weird anymore. We're pretty sure it happened even more quickly in a separate episode soon after the Big Bang in the event we call cosmic inflation. So this is a thing that seems to happen in our universe. Dark energy, whatever it is still a thing. But this new study is still very important. It demonstrates one of the greatest qualities of the scientific process and culture. No matter how well accepted a result is, everything we think we know is always subject to being questioned and retested. We now need to understand why the new result edged the confidence down. There were differences between the experiments, so what effect did these differences have? You can be sure that many scientists will be taking a long, careful look at the evidence for dark energy and its effect on the expansion of space-time.
Now, I should point out, these are part of a 6-pack of clips from PBS on dark matter. Check out the show notes for a link to the playlist. But we'll be back after this break.
Open Open Media International is a non-profit, non-partisan organization working towards informed, citizen-driven internet policy. Open Media believes in keeping the internet uncensored, open, innovative, secure, and providing universal access to fast and affordable networks. If you would like Open Media to keep campaigning for citizens and internet policy, you can donate to them at openmedia.org or openmedia.ca. You can also find them on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Google+.
Three women, dressed in lingerie, were hanging from the ceiling on meat hooks. In an adjacent room, a man was in bed with two deceased females, also wearing lingerie. He positioned their arms in a sexy embrace. Down the hall, a man holding a chainsaw stood over the motionless body of a sixth woman, lying on a table covered in plastic. These are scenes from a popular music video by a Grammy Award-winning artist. If we want violence against women to stop, shouldn't we stop treating it like entertainment? Join the conversation at #NotOkay.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver, your great source of skeptical information with a Sigma rating of 7. And we're back. Next up, we have a clip from In a Nutshell explaining how genetic engineering will change everything forever, in particular, the CRISPR revolution. Let's listen and learn.
Imagine you were alive back in the 1980s and were told that computers would soon take over everything, from shopping to dating and the stock market. That billions of people would be connected via a kind of web. That you would own a handheld device orders of magnitude more powerful than supercomputers. It would seem absurd, but then all of it happened. Science fiction became our reality, and we don't even think about it. We're at a similar point today with genetic engineering. So let's talk about it. Where it came from, what we're doing right now, and about a recent breakthrough that will change how we live and what we perceive as normal forever. Humans have been engineering life for thousands of years. Through selective breeding, we strengthened useful traits in plants and animals. We became very good at this, but never truly understood how it worked, until we discovered the code of life, deoxyribonucleic acid, DNA. A complex molecule that guides the growth, development, function, and reproduction of everything alive. Information is encoded in the structure of the molecule. Four nucleotides are paired and make up a code that carries instructions. Change the instructions and you change the being carrying it. As soon as DNA was discovered, people tried to tinker with it. In the 1960s, scientists bombarded plants with radiation to cause random mutations in the genetic code. The idea was to get a useful plant variation by pure chance. Sometimes it actually worked too. In the 70s, scientists inserted DNA snippets into bacteria, plants and animals to study and modify them for research, medicine, agriculture and for fun. The earliest genetically modified animal was born in 1974, making mice a standard tool for research, saving millions of lives. In the 80s, we got commercial. The first patent was given for a microbe engineered to absorb oil. Today, we produce many chemicals by means of engineered life, like life-saving clotting factors, growth hormones, and insulin, all things we had to harvest from the organs of animals before that. The first food modified in the lab went on sale in 1994, the Flavor Saver tomato, a tomato given a much longer shelf life via an extra gene that suppressed the buildup of a rotting enzyme. But GM food and the controversy surrounding them deserve a video of their own. In the 1990s, there was also a brief foray into human engineering. To treat maternal infertility, babies were made that carried genetic information from three humans, making them the first humans ever to have three genetic parents. Today, there are super-muscled pigs, fast-growing salmon, featherless chickens, and see-through frogs. On the fun side, we made things glow in the dark. Fluorescent zebrafish are available for as little as $10. All of this is already very impressive, but until recently, gene editing was extremely expensive, complicated, and took a long time to do. This has now changed with a revolutionary new technology now entering the stage, CRISPR. Overnight, the costs of engineering have shrunk by 99%. Instead of a year, it takes a few weeks to conduct experiments, and basically everybody with a lab can do it. It's hard to get across how big a technical revolution CRISPR is. It literally has the potential to change humanity forever. Why did this sudden revolution happen, and how does it work? Bacteria and viruses have been fighting since the dawn of life. So-called bacteriophages, or phages, hunt bacteria. In the ocean, phages kill 40% of them every single day. Phages do this by inserting their own genetic code into the bacteria and taking them over to use them as factories. The bacteria try to resist, but fail most of the time because their protection tools are too weak. But sometimes bacteria survive an attack. Only if they do so can they activate their most effective antivirus system. They save a part of the virus DNA in their own genetic code in a DNA archive called CRISPR. Here, it's stored safely until it's needed. When the virus attacks again, the bacterium quickly makes an RNA copy from the DNA archive and arms a secret weapon, a protein called Cas9. The protein now scans the bacterium's insides for signs of the virus invader by comparing every bit of DNA it finds to the sample from the archive. When it finds a 100% perfect match, it's activated and cuts out the virus DNA, making it useless, protecting the bacterium against the attack. What's special is that Cas9 is very precise, almost like a DNA surgeon. The revolution began when scientists figured out that the CRISPR system is programmable. You can just give it a copy of DNA you want to modify and put the system into a living cell. If the old techniques of genetic manipulation were like a map, CRISPR is like a GPS system. Aside from being precise, cheap and easy, CRISPR offers the ability to edit live cells, to switch genes on and off, and target and study particular DNA sequences. It also works for every type of cell, microorganisms, plants, animals or humans. But despite the revolution CRISPR is for science, it's still just a first-generation tool. More precise tools are already being created and used as we speak. In 2015, scientists used CRISPR to cut the HIV virus out of living cells from patients in the lab, proving that it was possible. Only about a year later, they carried out a larger-scale project with rats that had the HIV virus in basically all of their body cells. By simply injecting CRISPR into the rats' tails, they were able to remove more than 50% of the virus from cells all over the body. In a few decades, a CRISPR therapy might cure HIV. And other retroviruses, viruses that hide inside human DNA like herpes, could be eradicated this way. CRISPR could also defeat one of our worst enemies, cancer. Cancer occurs when cells refuse to die and keep multiplying while concealing themselves from the immune system. CRISPR gives us the means to edit your immune cells and make them better cancer hunters. Getting rid of cancer might eventually mean getting just a couple of injections of a few thousand of your own cells that have been engineered in the lab to heal you for good. The first clinical trial for a CRISPR cancer treatment on human patients was approved in early 2016 in the US. Not even a month later, Chinese scientists announced that they would treat lung cancer patients with immune cells modified with CRISPR in August 2016. Things are picking up pace quickly. And then there are genetic diseases. There are thousands of them, and they range from mildly annoying to deadly or entail decades of suffering. With a powerful tool like CRISPR, we may be able to end this. Over 3,000 genetic diseases are caused by a single incorrect letter in your DNA. We are already building a modified version of Cas9 that is made to change just a single letter, fixing the disease in the cell. In a decade or two, we could possibly cure thousands of diseases forever. But all of these medical applications have one thing in common. They are limited to the individual and die with them, except if you use them on reproductive cells or very early embryos. But CRISPR can and probably will be used for much more. The creation of modified humans, designer babies, and will mean gradual but irreversible changes to the human gene pool. The means to edit the genome of a human embryo already exist, though the technology is still in its early stages. But it has already been attempted twice. In 2015 and 2016, Chinese scientists experimented with human embryos and were partially successful on their second attempt. They showed the enormous challenges we still face in gene editing embryos, but also that scientists are working on solving them. This is like the computer in the 70s. there will be better computers. Regardless of your personal take on genetic engineering, it will affect you. Modified humans could alter the genome of our entire species because their engineered traits will be passed on to their children and could spread over generations, slowly modifying the whole gene pool of humanity. It will start slowly. The first designer babies will not be overly designed. It's most likely that they will be created to eliminate a deadly genetic disease running in a family. As the technology progresses and gets more refined, more and more people may argue that not using genetic modification is unethical because it condemns children to preventable suffering and death and denies them the cure. But as soon as the first engineered kid is born, a door is opened that can't be closed anymore. Early on, vanity traits will mostly be left alone. But as genetic modification becomes more accepted and our knowledge of our genetic code enhances, the temptation will grow. If you make your offspring immune to Alzheimer, why not also give them an enhanced metabolism? Why not throw in perfect eyesight? How about height or muscular structure? Full hair? How about giving your child the gift of extraordinary intelligence? Huge changes are made as a result of the personal decisions of millions of individuals that accumulate. This is a slippery slope. Modified humans could become the new standard. But as engineering becomes more normal and our knowledge improves, we could solve the single biggest mortality risk factor, aging. Two-thirds of the 150,000 people who die today will die of age-related causes. Currently, we think aging is caused by the accumulation of damage to our cells, like DNA breaks and the systems responsible for fixing those wearing off over time. But there are also genes that directly affect aging. A combination of genetic engineering and other therapy could stop or slow down aging, maybe even reverse it. We know from nature that there are animals immune to aging. Maybe we could even borrow a few genes for ourselves. Some scientists even think biological aging could be something that eventually just stops being a thing. We would still die at some point, but instead of doing so in hospitals at age 90, we might be able to spend a few thousand years with our loved ones. Research into this is in its infancy. And many scientists are rightly skeptical about the end of aging. The challenges are enormous, and maybe it is unachievable. But it is conceivable that people alive today might be the first to profit from effective anti-aging therapy. All we might need is for someone to convince a smart billionaire to make it their next problem to solve. On a bigger scale, we certainly could solve many problems by having a modified population. Engineered humans might be better equipped to cope with high-energy food, eliminating many diseases of civilization like obesity. In possession of a modified immune system, with a library of potential threats, we might become immune to most diseases that haunt us today. Even further into the future, we could engineer humans to be equipped for extended space travel and to cope with different conditions on other planets, which would be extremely helpful in keeping us alive in our hostile universe. Still, a few major challenges await us, some technological, some ethical. Many of you watching will feel uncomfortable and fear that we will create a world in which we will reject non-perfect humans and pre-select features and qualities based on our idea of what's healthy. The thing is, we are already living in this world. Tests for dozens of genetic diseases or complications have become standard for pregnant women in much of the world. Often the mere suspicion of a genetic defect can lead to the end of a pregnancy. Take Down syndrome, for example, one of the most common genetic defects. In Europe, about 92% of all pregnancies where it's detected are terminated. The decision to terminate a pregnancy is incredibly personal, but it's important to acknowledge the reality that we are pre-selecting humans based on medical conditions. There is also no use in pretending this will change, so we have to act carefully and respectfully as we advance the technology and can make more and more selections. But none of this will happen soon. As powerful as CRISPR is, and it is, it's not infallible yet. Wrong edits still happen, as well as unknown errors that can occur anywhere in the DNA and might go unnoticed. The gene edit might achieve the desired result, disabling a disease, but also might accidentally trigger unwanted changes. We just don't know enough yet about the complex interplay of our genes to avoid unpredictable consequences. Working on accuracy and monitoring methods is a major concern as the first human trials begin. And since we've discussed a possible positive future, there are darker visions too. Imagine what a state like North Korea could do if they embraced genetic engineering. Could a state cement its rule forever by forcing gene editing on their subjects? What would stop a totalitarian regime from engineering an army of modified super soldiers? It is doable in theory. Scenarios like this one are far, far off into the future, if they ever become possible at all. But the basic proof of concept for genetic engineering like this already exists today. The technology really is that powerful. While this might be a tempting reason to ban genetic editing and related research, that would certainly be a mistake. Banning human genetic engineering would only lead to the science wandering off to a place with jurisdiction and rules that we're uncomfortable with. Only by participating can we make sure that further research is guided by caution, reason, oversight, and transparency. Do you feel uncomfortable now? Most of us have something wrong with them. In the future that lies ahead of us, would we have been allowed to exist? The technology is certainly a bit scary, but we have a lot to gain, and genetic engineering might just be a step in the natural evolution of intelligent species in the universe. We might end disease. We could extend our life expectancy by centuries and travel to the stars. There's no need to think small when it comes to this topic. Whatever your opinion on genetic engineering, the future is approaching no matter what. What has been insane science fiction is about to become our new reality, a reality full of opportunities and challenges.
Lastly, let's end the show on a clip about who owns English. I mean, English is the most mongrel of languages, and yet it seems to be the most successful of languages. Let's listen to what ThinkFact says about English and its success and its weirdness. Let's listen and learn.
Language is extremely fascinating. It truly is the basis for how we perceive the world around us. Knowing more than one language can give you access to different perspectives. This is because a word with a single meaning in English could possibly be translated into a word that has multiple meanings in another language. And sometimes you get words that can't even be translated at all. But something so important must have somebody who controls it, owns it, right? So let's look at English, easily one of the most influential languages on Earth, but also one of the most influenced. Who owns English? Well, right off the bat, if you didn't say nobody, you probably thought of England or Great Britain in general. This is obviously the place of origin for English, but the language itself is a result of the unique mixing of French, Latin, and Germanic vocabularies for the most part. And after centuries of mixing, they would eventually harmonize into what is now known as English. But if we were to compare English of England today to the English of England 400 years ago, around the time it was colonizing the Americas and leaving the island, we can see some interesting differences. So here's some context. In recent times, there has been a large push for Shakespeare's plays to be done in what is known as OP, original pronunciation. Before the 1800s, English didn't have a true expected standard in terms of spelling, unlike we have today. People spoke how they wrote, and expert linguists such as David Crystal, have been able to use this to their advantage, as well as looking at how people rhyme certain words with one another and actual testimonies from that era. They've been able to actually decipher and put together actual pronunciations, organizing an actual accent for how people would have sounded back in that era. For example, we know through testimony that the word war once rhymed with the word star, being pronounced war. Here is David Crystal and his son both reciting a part of Henry V by Shakespeare, with his son speaking in his normal accent and David speaking in OP.
Oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention.
Oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention.
A kingdom for a stage, princes to act and monarchs to behold the swelling sea.
A kingdom for a stage, princes to act, and monarchs to behold the swelling scene.
Then should the warlike Harry, like himself, assume the port of Mars.
Then should the warlike Harry, like himself, assume the port of Mars.
And at his heels, leashed in like hounds, should famine, sword, and fire crouch for employment.
And at his heels, leashed in like hounds, should famine, sword, and fire crouch for employment.
Now, it should be noted, just like how there are numerous accents in the UK today, there would have been back in Shakespeare's time as well. Even looking at the Queen's English, typically upheld as the standard English accent in Great Britain, and the stereotypical posh-sounding one, it is known to be only about 200 or so years old. And as mentioned, we have England about 400 years ago sending its own native people, people whose ancestors took just as much part in the development of the English language as the people who stayed on the island, leave in order to establish colonies in the Americas and later different parts of the world. These people would obviously take their dialects with them, and through isolation, both their dialect and the dialect that was in Great Britain would further develop independently from each other. But arguing whether one is more correct than the other would be like arguing which of these two birds which evolved from this one bird is the one bird. The issue is neither of them are the original, and geography doesn't dictate that claim. Any more than geography, the place of origin, dictates the development of inventions like the computer, the car, or the phone. That said, it is still important to give credit where credit is due. England and later Great Britain are undoubtedly the reason why English is so successful and widespread today. Planting its seeds across the world by providing a language that offered opportunities, insight, and enjoyment, all in what would become the biggest empire the world has ever seen. And it's also made possible for people all around the world to contribute their own culture and language to the English language, expanding its vocabulary. Places like India, North America, and Oceania. And as the British Empire came to a close, the torch of a world superpower was passed on to the United States. A nation that would go on to become an economic, political, and cultural powerhouse, having an extremely powerful impact on the English language. Going on to further provide importance to English through the opportunities, entertainment, and insight it could provide. When it comes to true differences between Great Britain and the United States' English, their rules are just about all the same with exception to a few words that are spelled differently. And from there you have some cultural differences in terms of word usage and pronunciation. But that gap has been slowly closing due to the advent of massive cultural exchanges through pop culture, the internet, and many other means of connection. Hearing each other talk is no longer a taboo experience, and we are arguably in another stage of harmonization. And that's all that English has ever done, harmonizing itself into existence and further harmonizing itself to make it more diverse and relevant. So what does all of this mean? If Great Britain doesn't own English and the United States doesn't own English, who owns English? Well, believe it or not, the answer is pretty simple. You. You as an individual who knows English and uses English. People who are willing to learn a language and contribute to its usage and development are the people who take part in owning it. When it came to Great Britain, it was about going out in the world and finding new people to speak the language. And when it came to the United States, it was about people from all around the world coming to it and contributing their own languages to English. Two opposite situations incorporating the entire world, influencing each other. And with thousands of new words being added every year, not just from English speakers, English is continuing to get bigger and more diverse. To assume that anybody owns English is to assume that they control and approve every bit of development that the language goes through. And by the very nature of language, that's not how it works. We are not made for a language, and we should never limit our ability to express our ideas, thoughts, and culture if the words don't exist or are not practical. It's English's ability to be flexible that has made it very adaptable around the world. So whether you're from Great Britain, the United States, Jamaica, Ireland, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, or whether you're from Germany, Netherlands, Philippines, China, India, Sweden, Mexico. Wherever you are in the world, if you know English, you take part in owning it. Even though our influence on English may be minute, we all take part in its progression. And through that, we influence its development just as happened throughout the ages, since its origin. And being that we now live in a world where there are three, potentially four times as many non-native English speakers as native English speakers, we have to realize that they will have a big impact on the language. The United States currently has the largest single body of English speakers, but in the coming decades, India and China are both expected to bypass the United States, potentially even doubling the amount it currently has. And I'm interested to see what will happen in this coming century, as the population of English speakers is rapidly increasing, how all of them, you, will impact the English language that we all own a little bit of.
That's all the time we have this week. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you
must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.